Well, first there was Afghanistan, then Iraq, then Libya. All U.S. missions with very noble intentions, unfortunately deteriorating frequently into misadventures with deadly consequences. So, is Mali next in the queue? Well, our next guest says, France, Great Britain, and the United States fear Mali could become a new hub for al-Qaeda-style global terrorism, and some want to stop it regardless of cost and time. It would behoove them to examine some basic facts and problems before continuing such a risky endeavor in Africa. That, in yesterday's Washington Times, the author of that article is Fred Gedrich. He is a foreign policy and national security analyst whom you have probably seen on the BBC, CNN, Fox News Channel. He has been on hundreds of radio stations throughout the country talking about the global war on terror, and in addition to that, spent about 30 years in either the Department of Defense or the Department of State. So he knows whereof he speaks. I asked him to join us, and he does that right now. Fred, thanks for being with us.
Fred, delighted to be with you today.
So let's talk a little bit about what we should be looking at before we leap. What do we need to know about Mali before we intervene? And I guess I would say right now, at this point, all the president has said is we would be willing to refuel some jets above Mali airspace. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but we're already have had a relationship with Mali. We had some of our AFRICOM troops over there training in Mali military. And by the way, after they got trained, they overthrew their government.
Yeah, I guess we did a good job then.
With the Islamists up north. But and also Mali was pitched by the international community and also the United States as a model of democracy in Africa, the new Africa emerging. Right. And it really deteriorated, and that's my main concern. Enter into this with your eyes wide open, otherwise we can get involved in a real trap. And if we think Afghanistan and Iraq nation-building efforts or something, we're not only talking about Mali, perhaps, but the entire continent. That's going to cost a lot of money.
All right, well, tell us about the warning signs. I mean, I would think we would have learned them by now, but of the three examples I cited, and I might even throw Egypt into the mix, depending on how quickly it deteriorates. But tell us what United States policymakers should be looking at before we commit any blood and treasure to Mali.
Well, the first thing we got to do is recognize the growing influence of Islam on the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And since first entering Africa in the 7th century, Muslims now represent about 42% of the population. That's 460.
Now, that's of the continent, right? You're not
that's
just talking
the
about
the entire continent.
Right, okay.
And if you narrow it down to just Mali, Mali has a 15.5 million population.
Mm-hmm.
It's a country in the northwest part of Africa, with half of the country in the arid and in the Sahara Desert region, and the other in the savannah. And but 90%.
So just so that I know, I just want to stop you for a minute because I'm trying to get a picture. The Sahara, of course, would be in the north, and that would now be pretty much Islamic territory based on the success that groups terrorist groups have had up there. The south, the capital, Bamako, is the savannah, correct?
Right. It's in Mali is a landlocked country.
Yeah. Right.
And it's below Algeria and Mauritania, and the Niger River runs through it. And the Tuaregs, nomads, and the Ansar Dine Islamists have marched all the way down. They took Timbuktu, and the French just recently took that back and are making gains there. The problem is, if they succeed in regaining the key cities in the northern part of the country, then what happens? What will it take to hold those recoveries? And there's where the problems start.
What kind of petroleum resources are we talking about in Mali?
Well, we're really talking about gold and uranium. That's that tracks.
Uranium, as in nuclear weapons. Okay.
Europeans and Americans.
Okay. So obviously there are some resources we would want to protect, but given, and you obviously know a lot about the relentless march of Islam across northern Africa, How do you stem that tide? I mean, now we've got constitutions partially written by Americans in Afghanistan, Iraq, that are Sharia compliant. Obviously, the Egyptian constitution is looking more and more like that. How would we dissuade residents of those countries who are devout Muslims from accepting those kinds of constitutions, which are absolutely inimical to the United States?
Well, I think what we first got to do is educate the public, and that's what I tried to do with my article, and recognize that Islam is really a totalitarian system.
Absolutely.
It forces the collective will on people, you know, through Sharia law.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharia is the key for all the advances they're making. And there's various stages they go through. The Muslim Brotherhood takes a less violent approach in most cases to install Sharia, but the inevitable outcome is something we really don't like. And what we're seeing in northern Mali is amputations, beheadings, and other strict applications of Islamic law.
Let me ask you something. As somebody who spent a good part of his career in the Department of State, and I would assume trying to champion causes of human rights around the globe, what is it? What is the kind of willful blindness that takes over to the Department of State when they look the other way at the clear human rights abuses towards women and religious minorities? I'm thinking of Coptic Christians in Egypt specifically, but gosh, Assyrians in Iraq and elsewhere, and I'm sure Christian minorities have been persecuted all throughout northern Africa. Why do we look the other way so often when it comes to these kinds of abuses?
Well, I think there's a mistaken notion that a simple vote, a democratic vote, will result in democracy,
right,
and the type of democracy we've grown accustomed to in the United States. That is not the case, because whereas our government emphasized freedom of the individual, Sharia and Islam emphasize the collective will of the religion. And once it takes over, you see all type of mutations, which we're witnessing in North Mali, and we see with the Taliban in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
I know, but you know, just rattling off the countries you've had, Pakistan, Afghanistan, now Egypt, and how many times do you have to have a prominent Muslim Brotherhood talk about democracy as one man, one vote, one time? I mean, these are lessons that are not new to the curriculum, and yet we systematically seem to avoid them.
Well, it's a sad situation.
It is indeed.
I think what we were sold a bill of goods,
mm-hmm,
that this experiment in democracy in some countries, Islamic countries at that, where we're at now, we have to recognize it really hasn't worked.
Well, let me ask you something. Let me ask you something else, because you get to this later in your article, and I think it's worth pointing out. Obviously, countries like Great Britain and France, and much to a lesser degree the United States, do have a kind of colonial stigma in a lot of these countries. And you point out, particularly guys like Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe, have deep animosities towards Western nations because of those former colonial ties. By going into Mali and by going into Libya or any of the countries in the Maghreb or Northern Africa, don't we run the risk of creating another anti-colonial movement?
We certainly do, and that's one of my chief concerns. Let me mention a quick story. At the UN summit in Johannesburg, South Africa, I attended several years ago,
mm-hmm,
I saw Colin Powell, while he was Secretary of State, get up and speak, and he talked about freedom, democracy, respect for human rights, and the rule of law. And he was booed and jeered by the Assembly and also a lot of the NGOs that were in attendance.
Now, wait a minute. I want to say that again because it bears repeating. By the way, we're talking to Fred Gedrich, who has just written an excellent piece in yesterday's Washington Times called A Long Look Before a Leap into War in Mali. Now, what you just got through saying, Fred, is that Colin Powell, when he was the Secretary of State and essentially the bowsprit of American democracy and values, went to Africa, spoke about those values, and was booed by Africans.
Booed and jeered. He was followed to the rostrum by none other than Zimbabwe's dictator for life, Robert Mugabe.
And
the first word out of Robert Mugabe's mouth at that UN summit was comrades.
Oh.
And they jumped out of their seats. They started clapping. All right. And all of a sudden I realized we're in for a big, long problem if we ever get involved too deeply in Africa, because it's going to take generations to change the mindset of many of the, not only nations, but the people there.
Right.
And I don't want to belittle the poor people of Africa, because I went in a lot of villages during my various trips, and I met some fine people, and they looked to America for help and guidance and, you know, a way out of the predicament of the misery that a lot of them have in their lifetimes.
But let me ask you something about some of the organizations that are supposedly in place in Africa to create situations that could return peace to Mali and rectify some of the insurgencies. You're talking about the African Union and the Economic Community of Western African States. Are they really able to do anything, or are they simply just excuses to have meetings?
I think, just based on the attitudes I've witnessed during my various trips to Africa, that the responsibility has to lie on their shoulders. We can only do so much, but there's so much anti-American and colonial opposition and actually hatred that I'm not sure how much we can do with, you know, in succeeding at success in on the continent as a whole.
Are these organizations now pro-Islamist, given the relentless spread of Islam, certainly across northern Africa?
Well, 27 of 54 African countries are members of the Organization of the Islamic Cooperation.
Yeah, that's a UN organization. I know. Essentially, I think the OIC drives the train in the UN, which makes me reluctant to get them involved. But I'm just wondering, of the 27 nations you talk about that are OIC members, they would also be members of the African Union, right?
And many of them also the League of Arab States as well.
So I don't see many friends in that group, Fred, I got to tell you.
And that's what scares the heck out of me, because I don't know what good is going to come out of our another intervention, particularly in a place like Mali, where we're really going into sub-Saharan Africa. And there's nothing but trouble on the horizon. And the best thing we can do is just educate the public, put pressure on our members of Congress, and at least provide enough advice to the administration that you got to be really careful.
What you're talking about is not just leading from behind, but from behind a glass partition, because it sounds as though anything that we would do over there would probably come back to hurt us, particularly nation building, which is a concept that I don't think has fulfilled its potential at all.
Oh, not. It hasn't one iota. You just look at the statistics.
Now, having said that, let me just play the devil's advocate, and this will have to be our last question. Knowing that the Muslim Brotherhood is essentially the mothership for groups like Al-Qaeda and affiliates like Ansar al-Sharia and the Ansar Din jihadists that were affiliated with Muammar Gaddafi, can we afford to do nothing except advise? I mean, is there a certain national security ramification that we have to be mindful of for the United States?
Well, we should only act when it's in our national security interest. And one of the biggest problems I had with the military intervention in Libya was there was no U.S. national security threat in Libya at the time we intervened militarily. And we also didn't have permission from the U.S. Congress. And that troubles me very much.
Well.
And I think Congress has a big role in anything the administration has to do, particularly in Africa, because we could get in a lot of problems and we could wind up paying a huge bill when it's all said and done.
Yeah, and we
in
still,
blood and treasure.
And we still haven't settled our accounts in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and certainly in Egypt. Fred, we're going to have to leave it there. The article is called A Long Look Before a Leap into a War in Mali. The author is Fred Gedrich. He has joined us. Fred, thanks for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
We'll be right back.